Welcome to A Million Other Choices. Thank you for joining me. We discuss dark topics here, and sometimes things get hard to listen to. My focus is always on victims and their families and friends, which can be very hard to listen to, so please be advised of this. Ad-free episodes can be signed up for through Red Circle or Patreon, where you can also get access to full-length bonus content. You can make a one-time donation at Buy Me a Coffee. Disclaimer and sales pitch are done. Next up, legal. All sources are publicly available information, and I use a wide variety of sources to try to ensure accuracy, but I cannot confirm the accuracy of publicly reported information. If you would like a specific source or sources, please email me at amillionofthechoices@outlook.com and I will provide it to you. You can also email me there with case suggestions and just general comments. Okay, we are done. Let's get going with what you came here for today. First of all, there is a confession to watch and listen to here, like a police interview thing. Now, some of you love that, and some of you really hate that, so I put it at the end of my blabbering for you so that you can peace out whenever you're ready. I have a rather in-depth one for you today. I kind of made the mistake of paying for a subscription to newspapers.com, and it has sent me down some rabbit holes that it's just not even funny. But this is probably one of the worst cases of domestic homicide that I have come across. And unless you're in Eastern Canada, it wasn't really widely covered. So I think it's really important to bring some detailed coverage of it to other parts of Canada and to the listeners I have from many other countries that I am so grateful to for listening to my weekly rants. This is the Barutsky Murders. And I'm going to start this story in 1982 in a place called Round Lake Center. Now, I couldn't find a lot of information about Round Lake Center, but I know that Round Lake is a place that separates two provincial parks, the Bonnechere and the Foy, and that the center, or Round Lake Center, which is a small town, is within Renfrew County. It is west of Ottawa, about an hour's drive. Anyways, from pictures of it, it looks really lovely, like really lovely, like as in try to buy a cabin there if you can, kind of lovely. And within Round Lake Center lived two families, the Barutskys and the Masks, both nice, hardworking, honest families for the most part. Well, except one of the Barutsky's sons, who in 1977 was charged and convicted of assault causing bodily harm. And that would be the Barutsky's son, Basil. He was kind of known as a bit of a bully during his school years, and I don't have any details about this assault, but it sounds like kind of like a bar fight kind of situation between him and another man. And in 1982, Basil was working at Atomic Energy in Kitchener as a millwright. Kitchener is about a five-hour drive from Round Lake, west of Toronto, so he was living there at the time. And the Mask's daughter, Mary Ann, had also moved to Kitchener. I believe she was working as a server in a tavern there. Anyways, the two of them met and married and moved back to Round Lake Center together. And during the next 26 years, a number of things happened. Basil racked up a few charges, mostly alcohol related, but often involving threats to like neighbors and just random people. And one time he was charged with urinating in a courthouse jail cell. He kind of showed a rather disrespect for authority all around. And inside the Barutsky house, things weren't going too well either. In 1985, just a year before they would have had the first of three daughters, Mary Ann charged him with domestic criminal charges, which he spent $20,000 of their hard-earned money to fight and was actually acquitted of. Now, Mary Ann was afraid of what he would do if she left. So she stayed in the marriage, And of course, after his pleas of he was actually the victim and she was just being vindictive. And so in 1994, she tried again to charge him with domestic violence, but again, he was acquitted. So finally in 2008, she filed charges against him again for the third time for pulling her hair, slapping her, and trying to push her out of a moving vehicle, which were all witnessed by at least one of their daughters who did testify in court. Another daughter testified that he had repeatedly threatened to burn down the house that they lived in, and the house did in fact burn down to the ground later, but no charges were ever laid in that case. Now, these 2008 charges resulted in the charges being withdrawn when Basil arrived at court with a letter signed by Marianne reading in part, "I have made false statements about him. I have destroyed the children's lives unknowingly," end quote. Of course, she was actually coerced into signing this letter written by Basil, and Marianne felt at least a bit at peace that now at least she had a restraining order against him and that they were officially separated at that point. Now, the actual divorce proceedings didn't start until 2011. And again, Basil had said that he was just the victim of a vindictive wife and that she would do and say anything to take his children away from him. And he said that actually Marianne had agreed to giving him full custody of the kids and control of her finances in this contract that he produced. And again, Marianne had been threatened into signing it. Now, fortunately, the judge in that case threw out this little contract and he didn't buy his story. But he also didn't really do anything about the fact that Marianne had told the judge that she believed Basil had been stalking her ever since their separation 3 years before that. Marianne would fortunately manage to wrangle her way free of what she described as their wretched marital relationship. She continued to be a source of contention for him. He believed wholeheartedly that he was the victim of her sorcery and her mean-spirited lies that had been made up against him, despite the fact that she had physical bruising and signs of his abuse written all over her face and body. Unfortunately, even though she was free from the confines of an abusive marriage, Marianne's suffering kind of continued after that. She survived breast cancer, only to go on to have a stroke at some point, which left her with permanent hearing loss, and then was later diagnosed with fibromyalgia, living her days in pain and chronically exhausted. In the summer of 2005, so while Basil and Marianne were still married, Frank and Natalie Warmerdam moved from Toronto and their two children, Adrian and Valerie, to Renfrew County on Foymont Drive to raise the kids in a more rural and tight-knit community. Natalie had been working as a software writer, but she had gone back to school after her kids were born. They were a little bit older to work as a palliative care nurse because she wanted to do more meaningful work. This enabled her to sort of travel around the Renfrew County area, providing care to dying patients who wanted to spend their last days at home. But in 2010, her marriage to Frank had ended when he had left her and moved out. And although they stayed friendly, it was a really hard time in Natalie's life, and she was devastated by him leaving her. It really broke her confidence, and she developed some insecurities and anxieties, mostly about money and how she was going to move forward without him. Meanwhile, on New Year's Eve of 2010, Basil was stopped at a check stop and failed a breathalyzer that he later claimed was rigged. It was like he was once again the victim of a system that was aimed at taking him down. He believed that the OPP was out, which is the Ontario Police, was also out to get him because they had heard what Marianne had said about him. It was something like that. That was his side of the story anyways, why he was always being victimized and targeted by the police. Well, Natalie had not heard the rumors when she met Basil while she was caring for his dying father, and they became like friends at first, but it quickly becomes a romantic relationship. Now, Natalie believed very strongly Basil's stories that they were all these people out to get him because of these false accusations against him from this vengeful wife that he had, which I think is something that is tempting to do, especially when you're dealing with a narcissist that, you know, nothing is ever their fault. They can be very, I don't want to say charming about it, but they weave a very believable tale so that they can make you believe that they are in fact the victim. I think that the important thing to look for with people like that are, like, are they always the victim? Like, is there a pattern there? Is there anything that they can say was because of their own actions? But Natalie wasn't looking for patterns. Like, she was just thinking, like, oh my God, this poor guy and what he's been through. So she saw the signs that Basil had put up all over his property, listing all kinds of people's full names, including his ex-wife, saying in all caps, "Stay off," and anyone else who has threatened me, assaulted me, stole from me, forged my signature, made false statements about me, et cetera, or harass me, friends, welcome, you know who you are. And then he put a little smiley face on his sign. So Natalie saw these signs as like the actions of a desperate and victimized man, and not the red flags that Natalie's grandmother saw them as, because she had heard the rumors about his relationship with his ex-wife and the allegations that had been made against him. And of course, all this drinking and driving nonsense. And she tried to warn Natalie about him, but Natalie had a very strong sense of justice and believed very strongly that you are innocent until you are proven guilty. And none of the charges or allegations made against him had ever resulted in any kind of a guilty conviction. So therefore, it made sense to her that his ex-wife was maybe making it all up and was this proverbial crazy ex-wife out for revenge. By the spring of 2012, though, Natalie was starting to figure things out. Basil's drinking and his constant raging about how and who everyone had been wronging him was starting to wear a little thin on her. This was probably not helped by the fact that he had started telling her that if Marianne ever did manage to get him put in jail, that when he got out, he would immediately kill her and have no problem going back to jail for it. And so at that time, she told him that she wanted him out. She wanted him to move out. Only he refused and said that he was entitled to half of all her stuff, including the house that they were living in, because they were now common law. Well, Natalie had so much trouble trying to get him out that she moved actually into the guest room in her own house. And not that Basil let her get any sleep, though. He would stay up late into the night raging at her through the door. So Natalie started to wonder, like, what she had gotten herself into, like why she had believed these victim stories and how on earth she was going to get rid of this guy. Well, on July 27th, 2012, things got even worse for Natalie and her kids when, in a rage, Basil threatened to kill the family dog, skin her son Adrian if he got his hands on him. There was likely an assault towards Natalie involved in this altercation, but we're never actually going to know that because Basil managed to get the assault charges dropped by pleading guilty to the threats. So he was only sentenced to 5 months, which in her mind at least got her out of the house, but she was worried about when he was going to get out of jail, which turned out to be only 33 days later. But at least Natalie was told ahead of time that he was out, and it was put under a no contact order. So she was actually given by the police this panic button that she could wear on her. It could track her location, and then she could set it off if he came anywhere near her, because the police knew that he was dangerous. It was just kind of the courts that hadn't done anything about him at that point. Also had security cameras installed on her property because, like, well, she's terrified of this loser. So she's doing everything right on her part. Now, part of his probation was also a 10 years weapon ban. But we're going to see that Basil doesn't really care about rules and stuff. And after he got out of jail for this 30 days of incarceration, which I mean, frankly, I think even I could do 30 days. I think maybe not. He moved into this little farmhouse next to the scrapyard, which has Stephen King vibes written all over it. And it was about 35 kilometers away from Natalie's house. And that year he had a couple of chance encounters with two different women. The rundown farmhouse that he was renting was owned by a recently widowed woman named Carol Colton. She had met Basil at the Wilno Tavern and they had become friends. Now, Carol actually lived in Ottawa, but her and her husband had this summer cabin on Lake Kaminiskig, which she was going to be selling because after her husband's death and her being getting near retirement age from her government job, she was, you know, considering her long-term finances at that point. Around that same time, also working at the Wilno Tavern was Anastasia Kuzik, whose family referred to her as Stace. And Stace supplemented her income by waitressing at this bar, but she was also a real estate agent. And she had been the one that had introduced her to the property that was owned by Carol. Stace was an equestrian provincial champion and a lover of horses. In fact, she was rather passionate about it. But a recent breakup with her boyfriend left her kind of struggling financially and vulnerable in that heartbroken way that sometimes happens to us. So she bought a farmhouse for herself after this breakup, but it wound up needing a lot more work than she could really afford or could do on her own. And Basil, of course, offered his help, even though at the time he was collecting disability at this point for some kind of back injury that he had. But I guess in this case, manual labor didn't count. So there was speculation that they had started a romantic relationship, but regardless if it was romantic or otherwise, he quickly moved out of Carol's farmhouse and then into Stace's house. Oh, but before he did that, while he was investigating around this scrapyard next to his house, there was this old motorhome, and he found in the floorboards there a shotgun, and it was still in working order. And he also managed to find some half-rusted bullets that fit this shotgun and in some other cars and stuff that were in the scrapyard, and then stashed the gun and the bullets in this bush on the property. And when he later moved, he would always take this stash with him and hide it somewhere else. It was just in case he needed to use it one day. Oh, and of course, moving in with Stace was a violation of his probation. Not that that ever mattered to him. Now, I don't think Stace knew anything about Basil's past. And a background check probably wouldn't help that much because he never had any convictions for violence other than the assault that was in 1977, which by 2013 was years ago, and she probably would have just brushed it off as a misguided youth thing. He also managed to convince Stace that he was, of course, this victim of a system that was dead set on believing his ex-wife over the facts according to him, that is. Well, on December 30th, 2013, things kind of came crashing down when, in a rage, Basil threw all of Stace's family heirlooms, including an antique rocking horse, into a fire pit and lit it up on her, all while beating and choking her. And afterwards, she told one of the investigating officers, quote, "I honestly thought he was going to kill me. I could see the switch go off in his eyes. He kept hitting me and I was just begging him to kill me. It hurt so much," end quote, which is awful. When it was over, which was several hours after his rage had begun, she actually no longer recognized her own face in the mirror. She remembered that during the beating, he was telling her that it wasn't really about her, but it was for all the women that had tried to ruin his life. So in that case, he was convicted of overcoming resistance by attempting to choke, suffocate, or strangle, an assault and mischief under $5,000. Now, Stace was originally terrified. She really didn't want to testify against him, but it was actually Natalie that had worked to convince her to go through with it, because by this time, Natalie had figured out that unless they could get a conviction against him, he was going to continue to do this to other women, because without an actual criminal conviction, nothing comes up on a background check or your criminal background to sort of warn anyone that you might, in fact, be a douche canoe. So Stace did stand strong, and he was given 17 months for that, but he got out in 5 months for some reason. And of course, no one was advised that he was released. Not Marianne, not Stace, and not Natalie. Natalie only found out about it because she had gotten in touch with his parole officer and realized that he was under some parole conditions. There was a no contact order against her, which was great, and also that he was to attend this anti-violence counseling thing, which is also great, except the parole officer gave him permission to him to attend this counseling near where Natalie worked, which was against the restraining order. But he had allowed it anyways because, I mean, you know, you want this guy to be better. Like, you can't find a different place, whatever. Well, he, of course, never attended even a single session of that. And for that, he was not reported for being in breach of his conditions. His weapons ban was extended at that time from 10 years to a lifetime ban after that second conviction. No one knew about this little stash, of course, in the bush outside of his place. And if you're thinking to yourself, like, well, Kim, like, sure, this guy's a dick and clearly an abuser of women, but he hasn't killed anyone. Well, I say to that, as I would to any police officer, judge, or prosecutor, no, not yet, but you wait, it's coming. So by the spring of 2015, he had moved into this social housing complex at 5967 Palmer Road in Palmer Rapids, and he quickly befriends a few of his neighbors, particularly this one neighbor named Shirley, who he was at least kind enough not to start a romantic relationship with. Now, she considered him to be this really nice guy, and she thought he was very kind and generous, very thoughtful, very hardworking. She really knew very little else about him. So she started to give him permission to borrow her car, like, kind of whenever he wanted to. He was still unemployed at the time. He was living off this disability for his back injury or whatever it was. But again, he was busy wooing his neighbors, basically, by planting these gardens and doing stuff for them in exchange for whatever, using their cars or whatever he wanted. And that is about the time that he started to try to reconnect with Carol Colton, who was the widow from the Wilno Tavern that owns the cabin out at Kamineskeg Lake. And I might also mention here that Basil, by this time, well, he actually had a suspended driver's license, so he really shouldn't have been borrowing anybody's car for any reason. It sounds like Carol wasn't all that interested in keeping up her friendship with Basil, let alone any kind of ship. But Basil was his usual persistent self and started to show up at her cottage to do these odd jobs for her to help her fix it up for selling it, even though Carol had never asked him to do any of that and really didn't want him around. And if he didn't show up in Shirley's borrowed car, he would show up by boat over the lake. Like, just red flags. He even built a deck without asking her first. And she's like, what the fudge, guy? And now, fortunately, she lived in Ottawa and she had just come out sometimes to do, like, to the cabin. But when she did, every time he was always there. And one time he took her address on this from this Christmas card that was at the cabin that he saw there. And he drove the 2 hours to show up on her doorstep, uninvited, certainly unwanted. So Fred started to warn Carol that, like, this guy's acting pretty stalkerish, but she's trying to keep the peace. She just kind of wants to get through all this until she can sell the place and then it'll all be over. Well, over the Labor Day weekend, Carol had attended some kind of get together at the lake with some of the neighbors there. And of course, Basil had invited himself and showed up there. Well, Carol was just doing her thing. And I don't know if she was kidding around or joking, whatever. She jokingly sat on this guy's lap, or maybe it was a guy that she was actually interested in. It doesn't matter. She was not in any kind of relationship with Basil, but he didn't see it that way. So he went back to her cottage and ripped up her flower bed. And by this time, all this, these stupid discussions, or more like rages, that he kept having over Stace and Marianne and Natalie was wearing thin on a lot of people around Renfrew County. So the next weekend, when Basil again called her late at night, thinking he's calling up his girlfriend, she told him to bugger off and that she didn't want anything to do with him anymore, and to like stay the fudge off of her properties. As in plural, like, don't come anywhere near me. Well, he went off by text on her, sending her like hundreds of angry messages after she said, please stop. And this went on actually for a few days. Her friends told her to contact the police about it, but I'm not sure if she ever actually did that. I think she just kind of hoped that it was going to blow over and that he would, I don't know, find another woman to harass soon enough. Well, on the 14th of September, so about another week later, he had a meeting with his probation officer, one Carolyn Royer, and he did his usual complaining about the housing complex that he was living in, that he considered it a bit of a dump, and that he couldn't drive. He, of course, didn't bother to mention the fact that he was borrowing Shirley's car on the regular, like pretty much every day kind of regular. Carolyn knew that he had never attended a single session of his court-ordered anti-violence group. So why she didn't report any of that, I don't know. On September 20th, Carol sent a final text to Basil, hoping that he's going to finally get the hint and bugger off for good, saying, quote, my friend and I are back together. Please don't bother me. Instead of buggering off, he sends her back a text that she is a cruel, vindictive, self-centered human being and tells her that karma will take over. So she returned to the cottage because she had a meeting with the realtor on the 22nd. That was September, that she was looking to hopefully finally get this cabin sold and like out of her hair along with Basil. So the next day on the 21st, he showed up again at the cabin and confronted her there. I have no idea how that conversation actually went, but Basil told investigators later that she had told him that her and her new boyfriend made fun of him a lot and she was laughing at him. So he took a black permanent marker and wrote a bunch of, they were kind of like happy retirement messages, but he wrote them all over some wood pieces that he just scattered around her yard. And he did leave, but he also dropped a letter for her in the outgoing mail at the post office to her Ottawa address on his way back to his housing complex. So when he got home with Shirley's car, he was clearly upset and he was very agitated. And he told her that he had just caught his girlfriend in bed with another man, which was not true. So he had a few drinks with her to kind of calm himself while they discussed some passages from the Bible. I guess they like to talk about that kind of thing. And he talked mostly about passages that talked about the differences between killing and murder. And he said to her, this is the Bible I believe in, and I'm going to show it to the judge. So at some point that night, he went and retrieved the shotgun that he had stashed, this time in bushes that were near the complex where he lived, and then fell asleep on his couch. The next morning, he got up early, and at 7:30, he grabbed the gun and again borrowed Shirley's car, and then drove the 20 kilometers to Carol's cabin. Now, Carol was already up when he got there. She was getting ready for her meeting with the realtor. And when she saw him pull up in Shirley's car, she pretty much knew to kind of run inside the house and get away from him. But he smashed the glass in the door with his elbow and then forced his way in. And he caught up with her in her bedroom, attacked her with like an electrical cord, hitting her with it, and then wrapped it 6 times around her head and neck. And Carol's trying to choke out to him, like, this is not you, Basil. This is not you. And when she stopped trying to speak, like her her air supply had been completely cut off and she was no longer moving. He then smoked a cigarette, kind of considering his next move, and then butted the cigarette out in her sink before emptying her purse. He emptied her purse onto the table and then took her keys to her Mazda 3 and her cell phone as well. And then he got into her car and then drove off, leaving Shirley's car there. Carol's friend texted her at 9:23 that morning, expecting a response from her fairly soon. And when she didn't get one, she texted her again at 9:50, asking her to just call her whenever she did get the message. Well, when Carol's real estate agent arrived that morning at some point, the house was quiet and she noticed that Carol's car was gone, but there was this car in the drive that she didn't recognize. But she also noticed that the front door appeared like kicked in or kind of smashed in or something was wrong with it anyways. So she kind of gingerly entered, calling Carol's name, and then found her crumpled on the floor in her bedroom, just like she had been kind of discarded there. So she made a call to 911, obviously. Well, meanwhile, Basil had driven in Carol's car 33 kilometers to Wilno, where he burst through the door of Anastasia, whose sister Eva had been visiting, like she was staying with her at the time. So Eva heard Anastasia scream, so she rushed downstairs to see Stace screaming at Basil, who was like he had briefly left the doorway to go out to his car and was coming back with a shotgun. So Eva screamed at Stace to run, but as Eva herself was running from the house, she heard a shot go off. So Anastasia had tried to like duck for cover behind a kitchen countertop, but had been shot. So Eva managed to flag down a road crew that was working nearby and frantically used one of their phones to call 911. By this time, it was 8:52 a.m. So still using Carol's car, Basil then got back in it and drove the back roads to Foymont Road, where Natalie, Adrian, and Valerie lived. Now, fortunately, Valerie was at school at the time, but Adrian and Natalie were both home. And being a small community, and the sort of tensions from their original separation seemed to, at least from Natalie's point of view, had kind of calmed down. Natalie had returned to leaving the front door unlocked and had also stowed her panic button that she once wore very diligently around her neck, was now kind of like under her bed mattress. So Basil was able to just walk in the front door without anyone really hearing or noticing it until he was spotted by Natalie, who screamed and ran through the house and past Adrian, who at the time was laying on the couch in the living room and wasn't noticed by Basil. So as Adrian had sort of realized that something was really awful, like something really bad's going down, he jumped from the couch and then ran outside where he hid in the bushes. I think he was hoping that his mom was running towards the back door, but as he was exiting, he heard a shot. Now, his mom, Natalie, had been shot in the neck, and Adrian was only 20 at the time, so he was terrified. He stayed in the bushes until the police arrived later, and by that time, sort of an all-out manhunt was ongoing for Basil in Wilno, and Carol had also by this point been discovered in her lakeside cabin. The school that Valerie was at had been put on a lockdown because obviously there was an active shooter in the area, but Valerie had no idea like what was happening or that her mom had been killed until a police officer had her called to the principal's office. And until that point, she thought like it was just a drill or something that they were going through. Well, Marianne, who had once again started going by her maiden name of Mask, she was on her way to a doctor's appointment when she got a call from the OPP to get to a safe place right away because Basil appeared to be on a rampage and was taking out his grudges, which were mostly his ex-wives or ex-girlfriends. So she sped to the Provincial Park outbuilding where she hunkered down there. At 12:50, Carol's cell phone rang. Her friend was phoning actually to check on her because she'd heard on the news that Basil was going around shooting his exes, or at least somebody was going around shooting his exes. And at that point, Basil was heading towards White Lake, which was about 80 kilometers from Natalie's home. And so instead of answering the phone, he threw it out of the car window. And it was later found in a ditch about 9 kilometers from her home. In White Lake, he pulls into the parking lot of like Burnstown Road of this lumber company and asked two of the sawmill workers there if they knew where the big guy was. Well, they didn't know who he was talking about. So he drove around the property a little bit looking for this big guy. He didn't know his name, but he knew where he worked and somebody that had wronged him in some way. He didn't see him, thankfully. And so he got back into the car and then headed east. By noon, the police had started to include the Ottawa police into the search. They were concerned that Basil was going to start heading towards the city or that that's where he was going. And helicopters were deployed. Basil actually pulled into one of those highway pull-offs and left Carol's car near a camping area on Beck's Road in Kinburn. And then he sat down at a picnic table to write in his notebook. Now, beginning his entry in his notebook with the words, "I hate money." At 1:56, his neighbor Shirley, whom he had technically stolen her car from, got a text from him saying, "Your car is at the cottage. Sorry, I left $100 console for gas. Bye, friend." Now, he misspelled bye, but I'm assuming this was a goodbye message. He then sent a text to his daughter, Sarah, saying, "Sorry, Sarah, your mom took your dad on you. Amanda, too. I'm all alone. Nobody ever believes me." Now, the police contacted Basil's brother, Arthur, to try to make contact with him so that they could either track his location or get him to talk. And Basil confessed, I guess, as it were, to the murders. And he said, "Yes, I did it. The guilty have paid. Justice finally. I'm tired." And he ended the call telling him that there was a helicopter circling. Now, Arthur was actually aware of that because he had been taken by the police to kind of like a sniper location near Beck's Road in case they needed him to sort of help negotiate. He had been texting him actually from really nearby. So the police set up a perimeter. They were really concerned about the safety of the kids. There was a school about 800 meters from where Basil was. But Basil actually didn't put up any kind of fuss. He just walked out under his brother's instructions to come out hands up with no gun. And Basil, the first thing he asked them is, "Do you want to know where the gun is?" So he gave them directions to it and they found it. It was just lying in the grass next to this sandwich baggie of shell casings or bullets. And then he had a note sort of stuck to it on a branch that said, "I have no gun. Don't murder me. I give up." The Friday after the killings, there had a handwritten letter from him was delivered to the parole officer's office saying, "Judge not lest ye be judged. Now ye will be judged by me. I'm getting out and I'm taking as many that have abused me as possible with me. Justice." And then he writes "justice" in all caps. But based on his 4 hour plus confession, which I'm going to play bits of it for you in a little bit here, he pled not guilty to all of his charges, including 2 counts of first-degree murder and then 1 second-degree murder charge for Carol Colton. He even interrupted Justice Manger's instructions to the jury, calling him a liar, and reminded the jury that in his mind, at least, he was not guilty. But a jury, they didn't really take too long to find the now 60-year-old Basil Barutsky guilty of everything that he had been charged with. And I'm just going to read this from Justice Maranger's sentencing decision. Now, this is just part of it. The 22nd day of September 2015 will forever be remembered by the citizens of the counties of Renfrew and Hastings. It will be remembered as a time of terror and sorrow. It will always be considered one of the saddest, darkest days in the community's history. For on that day, Basil Borowski took it upon himself to exact vengeance, to act as judge, jury, and executioner against three beloved innocent women. On that day, Basil Borowski committed three vicious cold-blooded murders. The trial was supposed to last 17 weeks. It lasted 6 weeks. This was largely because Basil Borowski decided not to actively participate in his own defense. Despite repeated requests by the court, including requests during the pretrial motions, including a psychiatric assessment and jury selection, the trial, including this final stage of the trial. I borrow from the eloquent words of Natalie Waterman's mother, as I'm certain these words apply in some way to all the victims in this case. There is a huge hole in our lives and in our hearts. Daily, we walk under a black cloud. Our health and family dynamics have been sorely affected due to the everlasting stress and sorrow. When considering the other victims in this case, I cannot help but feel particularly sympathy for Eva Kuzik and Adrian Warmerdam, who will have to carry the real images of this murder, the everlasting memory of the terror of that day, for the rest of their lives in the loss of a sister and a mother. Basil Borowski has a history of violence against women. Two of the victims were subjected to his abuse in the past. He has several criminal convictions supporting this fact. In his statement to Detective Sergeant O'Neill, Basil Borowski came across as someone who sees himself as a victim of basically everything, of men, of society, of police, of the justice system. He goes so far as to indirectly blame the police and the justice system for his murdering of these three women, all of which is outrageous. He seemed incapable of taking responsibility for his many wrongs. As Amicus pointed out, there is perhaps some indication of an underlying mental health issue, but I conclude on the whole of the evidence that the character of the accused is that he is a violent, vindictive, calculating abuser of women who on September 22, 2015 took his hatred to his ultimate climax and committed the triple murders of Carol Coleman, Anastasia Kuzik, and Natalie Warmerdam. The sentence will be life imprisonment without the eligibility for parole on each count to be served consecutively, being a total of 70 years. However, 6 years later, Basil died of natural causes at the Millhaven Institution. He was 66 at the time, and I say good riddance to bad rubbish, I guess. Although withering away for years in prison, being sodomized by broomsticks and shanks sounds like a lot better of a punishment. So hopefully it was at least a rough 6 years for him. Bitter, bitter, bitter grudges. Like, I don't get it. And that whole narcissistic, like, I'm the victim thinking just drives me absolutely mental. Anyways, I'm going to play some of Basil's confession for you. The whole thing, like I said, is about 5 hours long, so don't worry. I have edited it down to the most important pieces. I think it is worth a listen, but I put it at the end because just in case you want to peace out or if you wanted to just peace in for this little bit and not listen to me, hopefully I have remembered to include a timestamp here somewhere that you can get to whatever point you want to get to. So until next week, thank you so much for listening and for watching.
You're here trying to get me to say something to incriminate me in any way you possibly can.
Well, that's not entirely true. I certainly am interested in what the truth is here today, but my primary purpose is to make sure that your rights as a Canadian citizen are being met. Okay. The thing is that the three individuals that were murdered are Carol Culleton, Anastasia Kuzik, and Natalie Warmerdam. And those are the three individuals that were murdered, and those are the three individuals that you've been arrested for. Okay.
I didn't murder anybody.
Okay. Do you know what your rights are, Basil? Now, obviously, as of right now, you have been arrested for murder. Okay? So, if you'd like to phone a lawyer...
For killing, not murder.
For killing, not murder. Okay. Well, I'm not here to prosecute you of anything. That's not my job, Basil. I'm not a prosecutor.
You're certainly not a positive person on my side.
Well, I mean, I think I made sure you had some clothing instead of that jumpsuit, right?
After you starved me all the yesterday, never fed me nothing, wouldn't give me nothing, not even water. Yeah, that was really nice.
But again, that wasn't me, right? I just got here this morning at about 8:30.
So-called brothers, great bunch of human car accident, and it broke all discs or whatever in my back, and I got a concussion, and I busted up my hand. I can't even remember what all. And the guy that hit me was telling the police officer, take this guy to the hospital, he's hurt bad. And he told a cop that about 10 times. He was sitting in the back seat of the cruiser. I was sitting in the front seat of the cruiser. When the guy got out of the cruiser, the cop looked at me and he said, you can fucking drive yourself to the hospital. And he turned and showed me a fucking criminal record that wasn't even supposed to exist. It was supposed to be wiped clean because I was found not guilty. So he fucking left me there on the side of the fucking road. And how I got to the hospital is beyond me. And I got no treatment because I went to a little hospital because I didn't know what else to do.
Are you retired now?
I'm disabled now from the accident.
From the accident.
And if you look that up on the record, it'll say there that it was non-life-threatening. It's amazing that I'm alive. So I know all about you good cops, so you are. If that's not malicious, I don't know what is.
So are you able to do anything else for work now?
No.
Were you able to get any sleep last night?
I have no idea if I slept on some steel bench. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine with my back what that feels like? No humanity whatsoever. When I asked him to loosen the handcuff because I had my hand cut off, who cares?
Is it when you were coming over from Ottawa, the cuffs were too tight, is that what you're saying?
And they left me sitting outside here in the car. I kept telling them I could hardly feel my fingers anymore. My whole hand swole up. No, it's not blue. I don't care. I have my hands cut off. I feel things a little different than what you do. I was only asking for common sense.
Is it fair to say that you're getting that from me now?
Getting what?
Common sense, some courtesy?
No.
And so what have I not done here to...
You're a police officer. I have lots of experience with police officers. I just told you about a car accident and how they treat me. So I don't trust you one little bit.
Okay.
I know all about your brotherhood. One of you fucks up or lies, the rest of you all hide it.
Doesn't sound like you've had very many positive experiences with policemen.
I've never had a positive experience with a policeman. Mm-hmm. If there would have been a positive policeman, my whole life would be different. My wife was having an affair with her first cousin. She called Kathy. Kathy called another cop named Ian Anderson, who was her boyfriend. He got involved and said that he had knowledge of me assaulting my wife, and he caused the police officer investigating to charge me for nothing. The officer never even met me, and he said he had knowledge. He's a liar.
And again, I've just met you, and I told you I have very limited knowledge of you. And I'm trying to learn a little bit about it.
What's the point?
Well, the point is that you're here, and I'm here. And
malicious prosecution, that's the point.
Basil, do you care what people think about you?
No, I don't. few friends that are really friends. The rest of the people in the society are all judging me now on what you have done to me.
Well, it's good that you have some good friends. I mean, most people can't even say that. Well, one of the reasons I'm also here, Basil, is that I'm sure you're aware of the gravity of the situation and the seriousness of this investigation. I certainly am, given that you've been arrested for these crimes. And there are no more serious crimes than murder.
I didn't murder anybody.
That's right, you killed somebody. Correct? Killed three people, actually. What's the difference between killing and murder?
Thou shalt not murder. Commandments.
Mm-hmm. So it's killing justified. Is that what you're getting at?
I'm saying that.
And I believe it's actually thou shalt not kill.
If you're wrong, you better start reading the Bible.
Yeah?
Yeah. Find an old version before they changed it.
Way back to the King James? Anyway, the importance is that you understand that obviously this is a serious situation. Frankly, Basil, that's why I'm here. In my experience, that the why these things happened carries a lot of weight, and it's quite important to other people. I'm sure you've seen the news over the years in Toronto, and they'll have fascinating headlines. Such as, you know, 60th murder of the year, 61st murder of the year. It'll be some story about an old man who was shot and killed in one of the projects and then left in a stairwell to die. And people will hear these stories and they'll wonder what type of person could do such a thing. That's a natural reaction that we as human beings have. Especially when you just see a half or a third of the story that the media portrays. And really, Basil, this is your opportunity here to explain why you've done these things. So one of the reasons I'm here is to give you this opportunity to explain why you killed these three girls.
You're putting words in my mouth.
I didn't say anything. I just asked you a simple question. Why did you kill these girls? That's it.
You're putting words in my mouth. I didn't say that.
Which words am I putting in your mouth?
What you just said.
And this is what I want you to think about, please.
This is what I want you to do. I want you to look into the past charges against me by those women. And I want you to do that proper investigation from the point of view of what really happened. And then have a retrial, a fair trial. And then we'll talk about reality. So any information you want from me, you can get by simply doing the proper investigation for the past. I was put in jail twice, wrongfully. Now go out there and find. You're a good cop. You go out and find out why that's wrong.
What,
it's not hard. It's
what were they for? What were you in jail for?
You don't have to look very hard to figure out that, no, it's right. Basil should not have been in jail. After you do that...
First step of the investigation is tell me what I'm investigating. What were you charged with?
Don't play me for stupid. You know exactly.
I don't know, Basil. I don't have to play you for stupid. I don't have to pretend when I don't know what you were charged with. I understand you have a criminal
record. I think you're stupid right now to talk to me as if I'm stupid. Just go out there and punch the computer. Don't talk. Don't act like I'm an idiot.
Well, here's the other thing, Basil. The reason why I'm asking is whatever common criminal offense you were charged with, I don't investigate. I only do homicides.
I guess that's why you're not going to figure it out, because you're not smart enough to go back and find out. Maybe you could find out that, geez, Basil was innocent. Maybe you could find out that some of these cops done some pretty bad things, and they framed Basil. Maybe you could find out some of the reality, and all the pieces might fall into place.
Well, what did they frame you about? What did they do? Was it about women? Could it be
another? Did I already tell you some stuff?
Could it be another?
Did I tell you about a Kathy Sanofsky and an Ian Anderson? Did I tell you? Did you write that down?
Those are just names. I don't know what.
Constable, then write that down. Constable, and find out. Look into the past. What their big mouths had to say. The lies they told. Try that out for style. That's a really good place to start. Look at Reggie Ramones. Look at her party. Find out that I told the truth through that whole thing, and she lied through the whole thing.
Well, I can't say that I'm shocked about women lying about some kind of domestic situation. That doesn't shock me at all. When I was a road constable, all I dealt with that lots of times.
Women use the system to their advantage financially for
every
reason they can.
Of course they do.
Well, that's corrupt. If you know that, you should be doing something about it.
Well, what would you like me to do about it? That's the way the world works, Basil. That's the world we live in.
Well, you are a stupid fucker if you believe that. If you know that, then you're a cop. You should be trying to change it, shouldn't you? You should be making it right. You know the difference between right and wrong? I do.
Mm-hmm. So do I.
Well, obviously not, because you just said that's the way the world is. What a stupid thing to say. If it's wrong, you change it. You're a cop.
I'm one cop, right? I'm one person.
And that means you can't do nothing about it, eh?
No.
Yeah, you don't even open your mouth and voice an opinion.
Maybe sometimes you got to take the path of least resistance, Basil.
Yeah, because then you stand back and let people like me take the fall. Accuser.
I would say the most horrible thing you could do is take the life of a woman. Kill a woman. That would be the worst thing you could do, yeah, I would say. I think there's a lot of people that agree with me. I think you agree with me.
You should re-educate yourself.
You think killing women is okay? It's good?
Don't put words in my mouth. I never said no.
I don't need to put words in your mouth. They're coming out just fine. I'm just pointing out some fairly obvious observations.
I'm talking about the reality of how things get to where they are.
The reality is three women are dead. You killed them, and you're talking about how you were wronged years ago in some kind of cheesy, domestic assault charge?
That's what you hear?
That's what you're telling me. Okay. Two ex-girlfriends of yours.
Three?
No, I don't think Natalie was. I think she turned you down, right?
I lived with her for 3 years. What are you talking about? Came for half the farm.
Sorry, Anastasia is the one that turned you down.
Turned me down.
She's quite a bit younger than you, too. You're not the first guy to be turned down, though.
I wasn't turned down, Anastasia. I was dating Carl Culleton, and I was working in Anastasia's house.
Okay.
She was a friend, like a daughter.
So what did these women do to you that made you have to kill them? That's the burning question of the day.
So I'm in jail for nothing, and that doesn't matter to you?
Not right now, no, because you going into jail for a little while kind of pales in comparison to being dead. Don't you think?
I think it's quite important that when innocent people go to jail, the police don't do anything about it. They don't investigate, they don't care.
Well, why do we have to do anything about it when we have you to take care of these problems? It's very evident what I'm talking about. We're way beyond. Listen, I don't know if you noticed this or not, but the question out of my mouth this whole time we've been here was certainly not, did you kill those three girls? Because you did. That's very clear from this investigation and witnesses and evidence. I'm not asking that question. That's not a question I need an answer to. That's not what I care about. It's irrelevant. It's a moot point. My only concern was why you did this to them. What could they possibly have done to make you so angry that you decided in September of 2015 to go and kill these three women?
I believe believe that time that the wife took off with her first cousin and lived with him for 6 months. And
your wife?
That's right. Okay. And then she made a fictitious charge that supposedly happened years before, or whatever you call it, just so that she could get custody of the children. And she got Kathy and Ian to call the officer investigating Reggie Armonis. And the first thing Reggie did was the proper thing.
Hold on a second. Reggie Armonis?
Armonis. Pembroke Police at the time. I don't know where she is now.
Armonis. Pembroke Police. Okay. Sorry. So Reggie was investigating. So she said she made up some story, you're saying, to gain leverage.
Ian Anderson wasn't even a cop here. He was somewhere in northern Ontario, and Kathy was here, and I don't know where she went to college. She went up there too after. Then she broke up with him, and she married some other cop here. But she got, the ex-wife got Kathy to phone and talk to Ian. Ian phoned Reggie, said that he had knowledge of me assaulting my wife, which is direct lie, because I've never met the man in my life, so knowledge is knowing. And then Reggie came back and turned around, the whole story changed. Reggie told me to take my child home, which I did. Everything was good. When I brought the kid back, all this had gone down, and I ended up getting charged with a historic six-year-old something. And then and my ex-wife charged me twice.
So
with charges.
Basil, what was your wife's
name? I'm still talking. I didn't butt in. Or, you know, please don't butt in. If you want to hear the story, let me continue.
I just need to know, is this a different case so I can box it off?
It's the same case.
Okay, same case.
Why do you think cases are just like a few words and it's over?
No.
There's a reality to things, you know. Truth. If you read the Bible, maybe if you had a little that in you, you'd understand.
Okay. Can I just ask why you
No, stop. My ex-wife was seeing her first cousin, and she thought she was going to lose custody of the girls. So she made up all these stories about me raping her assaulting her, and I forget how many charges, 12 something, and they were all in the I was found not guilty of, but I was run through the ringer, my reputation ruined, and all because she couldn't face the truth, thought she, the only way was to keep her, the children, or get custody, was to say bad things with her. She even went to the shelter months after she was living with the guy, pretending that she was afraid of me. Why would she go to a shelter? Get Basil. And then there's, even with Anastasia Kuzik, she sells my tractor. When the police are called, the police officer says, that's stealing, that's theft. When the police officer's called, he says, we're not going to do anything about it. It's a sensitive situation. Sensitive? She stole my tractor and sold it. What does that make her out to be? And the police protected that theft. The police have never treated me fair. The system has not treated me fair. I never lied in court. I never lied with my ex-wife. I never lied with any of it. But the court system seems to want to believe the lies instead of the truth. You got to start from the beginning where the seed was sown, and then you'll see how it snowballed and snowballed and snowballed to the point where Natalie took advantage of the system and Anastasia took advantage of the system. Because the police had built me up into, it was just so easy for them. I met Natalie at hospice. She was a nurse there approximately 5 years ago. She put the make on me. I didn't even know what was going on. I was trying to take care of my father. She told me later that she was trying to pick me up because she thought my family had money, and she was getting divorced. and she got what she wanted. And then she ditched me when it was over. She simply moved on to one of my hunting buddies, and then on to somebody else, and then on to somebody else, and whatever.
There's a purpose to this killing, in the burden that you're trying to take on to change society.
It's called justice. I have never had justice in my life.
From what you've told me, I understand how Natalie and Anastasia fit into this, but I don't understand Carol.
It's the very same thing.
In what sense? What did she do to you? Did she make some allegation against you that was untrue?
Lie for money. Lie for work. And it's Natalie. I spent $200,000 there minimum. She wouldn't even work. She lived off of me. I worked on a farm 3 years and brought it back. I turned it into a farm. She told me everything it was doing was what she wanted. And then when the court system told her, she fought because she thought we were going to get all the money. She was actually practically my lawyer. When she found out that I was going to get nothing, because as the judge said, he didn't believe a word I was saying, and every word I was saying was gospel truth. He chose to not believe it, not see it, not want to know the truth. And he told, I didn't even know it was possible, he gave everything to my wife, and he made me buy my own hunt camp back. So I got nothing. She started hunting for somebody else, and that's when the false accusations came. She knew it was so easy because she had just gone through the system. She simply said I was going to hang her son, threatened. I did no such thing. I said, he walked across the kitchen floor that I was washing. He walked into an office, looked back, went like that, walked back across the floor. I mopped it up. He turns around, back. He did it about 5 or 6 times. I wanted to hit him with the wet mop right in his face. And I told Natalie when she got home what he'd done. She would come back and says, yeah, he admits it.
Sorry, yeah, he what?
Yeah, he admits it. That was it. No reprimand, nothing. They didn't make him come and apologize, didn't make him. I actually, after, but started believing that she put him up to doing it because it wasn't much longer after. Then when I told her I wanted my money back, that was it. She went off the handle, flew. Went up to her dad's, and next thing you know, the police are there, and I'm charged with threatening to hang him, when all I said is, if you don't smarten up, I'll string you up. Meaning, listen, kid, do I deserve to go to jail for that? No. And Anastasia, I was dating Carol Culleton. Anastasia came along. Well, I knew Anastasia way longer than Carol, but I treated Anastasia like a daughter. She was a friend. She lived in my house with her boyfriend. She tried to sell my land for me as a real estate. All friends, she used to come to the farm, Natalie's farm, my farm, and used a hot tub with us, her and Eric. They were like friends. So I went to help her because her and Eric were splitting up. She said she needed help to fix the house up. I agreed to help as much as I could. I ended up kind of half moving in. I still maintained my place. But in the winter, when it got cold, I ended up staying more and more at her place than at my place. People may have assumed that there was a relationship going on, but they would have to be cuckoo because there was a 20-some year age difference. And if you don't believe me, simply go and talk to my doctor, because I told my doctor she wanted to have something. She walked around, she'd get in hot tub naked. You ask my doctor. I went there and I said, what is wrong with me? I cannot get an erection. She does all this to me. She'd even sit on my lap. He said, Basil, it's psychological. She's more like your daughter. She's more like your daughter's age. You see her as your daughter. It was actually a turnoff. But in court, when they asked her if we had a relationship, she said yes. And the reason was, or if they said, were you in a relationship? She said yes. That was a lie. She may have wanted it to be more when she tried to part Carl and I, and eventually she did. And Carl knew all of this, and I wanted Carl to go to court and testify that she knew all about Anastasia and me treating her like, or calling her like a daughter. And instead, Carl took off with another guy. Can I keep talking? Why do you keep butting in?
I think I'm doing a good job.
No, you're not. But you're butting in when I'm trying to tell you something. Her and I were talking about the Bible. She's religious. I am not. I tried to explain to her that I'm not religious, but I am spiritual, and I read the Bible, and I understand it more than most priests, and I will debate the Bible with any pastor or whoever wants to talk, because if they're wrong, I'll show them the Bible where they're wrong, and I've done it many times. And basically,
well, I think one thing about the Bible, you bring up some good points that I think need attention. Well, you have a lot of important things to say, and I can't keep up with a lot of them. I guess that's my fault. But what I'm saying is, the one thing about the Bible and spirituality that I think we could probably agree on, and that the majority of people would, is really, it's about balance. That's very clear from everything that you've been saying here this whole time.
If you think that this happened because I was going to change the justice system,
I think we both know that it can't be changed. You just want to draw attention to the fact that it's flawed.
Can't be changed.
Well, it all comes back to the very simple question of why this happened. So why did this happen, Miss?
We're having two different conversations here at the same time. I'm talking to you about being a police officer, and you know it's wrong. You don't try to change the system. Me, I've got nothing to do with changing the system.
This is your time. What is it you want to draw people's attention to? What is it, Basil?
I don't want to draw people's attention to anything.
You certainly have drawn attention.
I want it to be left alone.
I'm going to suggest that killing three women is not the way to be left alone, my friend.
I have nothing left. You stuck everything.
Well, they've taken things from you, yes. And that's why I say...
Use. Your brother.
Me? No, I've taken nothing from you.
Well, the police have. If the police would have done a proper investigation... at any point, any time, and proved, instead of trying to prove that I was guilty when I was not,
I want to know more
proof when I was innocent, nothing would have ever evolved to this point. Couldn't possibly.
I want to know more about this investigation you're talking about. I'm going to go and give this to my partner and have her pull out the report, because I want to see it, okay?
The night before, and I was talking to her about the part where the Ten Commandments, and she said, it's thou shalt not kill. And I said, no, If you look in the newer Bible, it'll say, thou shalt not kill. In the older original Bibles, it's thou shalt not murder. And I explained to
her. Yeah, I made that same mistake.
I keep talking. I don't like to interrupt because I lose my train of thought.
Sorry.
I explained to her that if it said, thou shalt not kill, it would mean not be able to kill an animal for food or whatever. For various reasons, people kill for sport, kill for food, you kill for whatever. And I said, that's why it's murder. And I said, when you kill a murder, it's killing something. Murdering is killing something innocent. And which I abhor, how do you ever say the word? I hate child molesters. I hate what happened to my ex-wife. I know that that destroyed her, that she never had a life. I know that that played a big part in what he done to her, has played out on me as the bad guy. And then so it just keeps rolling. I understand that. I read every psychology book I could to try to help her. But after 27 years of abuse from her, or her seeing me as abusive because I'm trying to help her, and her family wanting to hide their family secret, because that's what they call it.
Okay. So this is happening in Palmer Rapids.
So we were talking, and I guess whatever our end conversation was, when I fell asleep, I must have dreamt about it. Or, I hadn't slept. I kept telling everybody in that building that I am tired. I haven't slept in days. Everything is going anywhere. And I was talking to the crisis people. I'm trying to get help. And somebody, I need somebody to talk to. And nothing. I got no one I'd even talk to. My probation officer was one of the best ones for trying to help me, but that was not even her job. And I ended up with basically nothing anyway. And I kept telling you, I'm gonna explode. I can't handle it anymore. Everything is too much. I never dreamt that. And it comes to the point where there is no justice for Basil, regardless of what happens, what he says, it'll just get worse and worse. And I guess you give up and the stress level comes. Anyway, all I remember was going to sleep, or I don't even remember going to sleep, and then I woke up, and I don't even know if I drank coffee. I just went out of the house, and I remember at one point thinking about a zombie, and I remember I was confused, and I remember seeing the Our Father. He had been married over and over and over, and I was driving, and I said, I was talking to myself out loud, or I think I was, maybe I wasn't, but I kept saying, God, keep me safe, show me what to do, or stuff, or, and I don't know what, I don't. The gun, I had the gun 2 years ago when Carl Culleton and I first got together and I was living on a farm. I found a gun in the scrapyard in an old motorhome that was hidden under the floorboards. And I was pulling, I forget how I found it, I was pulling, looking for something, and I found the shotgun. And then I collected shells out of every car that's gone out of every car. I get two out of this car, three out of this country atmosphere, and I was living near a scrapyard next door. I collected the shells. If you look at them, half of them are rusted, and I don't even know if they. And that was because at that time Carl would visit me there at the farm. And the police would drive by and they'd shine lights, stop in front of the house, shine lights in my windows, and it was freaking Carl out, and it kind of destroyed her. She was And I was totally honest with her. I told her my whole history and she knew I was going to Anastasia to work on the house to help her so she could get money to pay Eric. But Anastasia twisted that around to make it look like we were in a relationship so that she wouldn't have to pay, because the whole thing was in the end. I told Anastasia, that's it, I'm out of here, you're not even trying to get the house, what do you call that, appraised. And I told her I'm going back and reestablishing myself with Carl, because me and Carl had drifted away a bit because I wasn't. And Anastasia went ballistic, locked me out of the house, bare ass in the middle of winter. 40 below, I'll never forget that. It was one of the coldest nights. And then when I finally got in the house, she just laughed. I asked her, why'd you do that? She, like a psycho person, just
Basil, I'm confused about one thing here. I'm hoping you can clarify for me.
I'm confused. I'm wishing I could figure this out.
The information we have, Carol Culleton. Our information is you just met her in September, is that not correct?
No.
Through the Wilsons?
No, the Wilsons. I don't even know them. I met the Wilsons through Carol.
So how long have you known Carol for?
Approximately 3 years. Before...
And are you in a relationship with her?
Yes. Carol and I had sex, no problem.
Okay.
When I went to help Anastasia tried. She walked around naked. She tried and I couldn't. I went and told the doctor there's something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. This young whatever struts around. She even thought that would sit on my lap. And nothing. And my doctor told me, Basil, all the things that have happened with women with you, it's psychological. She's like a daughter to you, and it never happened. The doctor even gave me Viagra, because I thought there's something severely wrong with me, and it didn't even work. And then I thought it was because of my hernia, that was my thing, and I don't know. But then when me and Carol went back together, it seemed to all work again. I don't understand.
What was God telling you to do? What was he telling you?
I believe that God was telling me where to turn, because I was driving on roads that I didn't even know where they were going. I remember being in Dacre and I was wondering, what the hell am I doing here? And then in a bunch of little towns. And, I remember I pulled into some little, like a park, roadside park place, and I drove around in a circle. And then I drove back out on the highway, and I remember saying, I don't understand why you wanted me to do that, but there must be a reason. And that would have been, I don't know where that was.
What happened at Carol's? Can you remember that? At the cottage?
I remember. I was at the cottage the night before.
On Tuesday.
Okay. You said today's Wednesday.
Today's Wednesday. So you were arrested yesterday afternoon in Ottawa. If that helps.
Tuesday. I was arrested.
Yes.
So Monday, I was at the cottage. And that's when Carol was, I already knew about her and the other, she had told me, but that's when she said that, her and her man called me BF, and she said that they thought it was funny. And he kept texting her, and she was laughing in the house. And she told me that they had this joke about me being BF, best friend, the guy that would do anything. And said she asked for nothing or whatever.
Why would she tell you that? Why would she try to hurt you like that?
I asked her that. I asked her in my text to her. I asked her, why would you hurt me like that? I don't know.
Why would God have you kill those women, Basil? That seems kind of counterintuitive. No. What reason could there be for that?
No, to me it seemed like God was trying to show me that the commandment isn't thou shalt not kill, it is thou shalt not murder, and that when somebody, it's murder to kill somebody that's innocent. That's why I couldn't kill myself, because I thought about shooting myself, but I can't do that. Because I am innocent, didn't do it wrong. Because that would be me murdering myself. Does that make any sense?
It does.
And so no, the way you're saying it would be counterintuitive, no. It seemed that I understand it, that that's what God was saying was the right thing to do.
So in terms of Carol and Anastasia and Natalie, would you say you killed them or murdered them?
I killed them because they were not innocent. They were guilty. I was innocent. I done nothing. And lying to the police to achieve, I didn't lie. It's all about lies, not about the money and the things. It's lying. I will not lie. If I do tell a lie, it's to protect somebody, like my daughter, or I will avoid. And that's a lie, to avoid sometimes, but it's always to...
Basically, you tell me that you don't lie, and you would only lie if you were protecting somebody from...
Which I would call it.
Yeah. Are you lying to me when you say you don't remember how you killed those women? When you're talking about this zombie and seeing outside yourself and God telling you,
I never told you that. What did you say?
When you tell me that you don't remember clearly what's happening... After you left Elizabeth. Remember you talked about, you said you feel like a zombie?
Yeah.
And you don't remember everything? Are you lying about that?
I never said I don't remember. I think you're putting words in my
mouth. No, that's the last thing I'm trying to do. I was trying to clarify what you're saying. That's all I want to do. I do not want to put words in your mouth. I just want to understand what you're saying.
I'm not lying about zombie. I'm not lying about driving.
Okay.
I'm not lying about praying. I'm not lying about asking God to show me where to go. And because I wondered why I'm in Dacre and wherever I was. I don't remember Dacre. I'm going to sign. And
did you want to?
What are you asking me? Am I lying about?
When you said you felt like a zombie and you couldn't remember.
No, I'm not lying.
Okay.
I'm telling you.
That's all I was asking you.
No, you just said more. You asked me if I was, you were putting where. That's not what you asked me. You asked me if I remember.
If you do remember everything.
I don't remember the name of it.
Okay.
I think that some. I remember more this morning. I sure as hell did last night because when that guy wanted to talk to me, I told him on the phone, I said, I don't even want to talk to you. I don't even want to listen. I'm so tired. And he said, well, then hang up the phone. I don't know what he said. I don't know.
Well, you know lots of things because we've been talking for a while now, and clearly you're doing a great job of remembering some things and you're understanding what I'm saying, and you're aware that you can talk to a lawyer at any time. So, I mean, you're clearly with me in the moment right now, I would say.
That God is really helping me, because when I went to Carl's, Carl walked right outside.
Mm-hmm. What did she do?
And then I asked her, I said, why do you hate me? Or why are you doing this to me, Purple? And then she closed the door. I was right there. And then I broke the window with my elbow. And I reached in and I unlocked the door. And she said, this is not you, Basil. This is not you.
You know what happened?
Then she told me that Dave was coming over because the hydro was out. And I said, you're lying to me again. And there was a cable TV coil. I picked it up and I hit her with it and I wrapped it around her head.
And I remember God's helping me do what's right. I remember God saying, not saying, God never spoke to me. I remember thinking that God's making this easy because Carl came out the door. Because when I got the anesthesia, she walked out the door. As soon as I walked, I didn't even, wasn't even at the door, she just walked out. And I asked Anastasia, I just said, why did you lie in court? And she said, I didn't. And the gun went off. Because it just lies. And I, no.
Where did she get shot, Basil?
What do you mean?
What part of her body?
I have no idea. She ducked down the little island. I don't know.
Behind a little island?
There was a little island. And she was standing and she just went down, and the gun went off after she went down.
This farm, Basil, is Foymont Road. That's the one you're talking about?
Yeah. I think that's the name of it. What happened when you went to Natalie's farm on Tuesday?
What happened? I just drove in, walked in the door. She was sitting there. She went around the corner. I followed her. Boom. Walked out. That's it. I don't think it was. And it was funny. It was like I wasn't even pulling the trigger on the gun. The gun was just going off. It was just like, boom. Anyway.
Do you understand how what's happened to these three women is wrong?
Yeah.
Would you take it back if you could?
Of course you would. But I don't know. Why? I have a lot of bad bone in my body. So many people know about all the things my ex-wife done. I have been told I would never put up with that. I would be so mad. I would kill her. All of these things. And I haven't any time anyway. I said, all I feel is pity. I feel sorry for her. I've told my kids, I feel sorry for your mother. And I tell them that if they could help her, I can't anymore.
Okay, Basil.
You know, I don't think I ate in days either because I've had the diarrhea or today and it just smells like sulfur.
Yeah.
I don't know what's.
I don't know what that means.
I've never.
So listen, we're going to get you over to the courthouse, okay? We got to go.
What time is it?
It's about 2:30. So if you want to eat your sandwich and then you can throw your
shoes. I'm afraid to eat it because my stomach.
Oh, I see.
They gave me a granola bar or something about right after my stomach just started.
They gave me a gargling here. Well, if you feel like you have to eat if you don't want to, all right?
Well, I'm going
to
shit my pants. That's what I'm worried about. Dude. How can they put that on me? That's malicious. That is, they forced me. I can go on and on and on. I didn't get here by myself. You fuckers drove me crazy. I begged you to do something. I went to the Pembroke police and I fucking told them that about the wife beating me up. I told them one thing about her slapping me in the fucking nothing. I told him about that Laura. That asshole cop covered that all up. I don't know how.
You've covered a lot of ground, Basil, and I can understand why you'd be upset with all things we've talked about here.
It's not upset. I never, ever, through all of that, ever thought about anger. It was always, I told people, it's frustration. I'm not angry. I'm frustrated. Nobody's listening. Anger would have been, I would have shot a cop a long time ago. How many years? 20 years went by? I never had the thought. All my things were about making right, fix it, help my wife, get the truth to come out. I always believed that someday, maybe, I will be vindicated, even if I only had 3 days of life where I fucking feel like I'm normal, like fuck. I never deserved one of these fucking things. Not one.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.